Busoni at Carnegie Hall. In our next program, you will hear conversations with several people who were associated with the early 20th century composer Ferruccio Busoni. And at the end of the program, a recorded performance of the fourth and fifth movements of Busoni's piano concerto, which will be given its New York premiere this month at Carnegie Hall. The interviewer is John Whiting.
He was a philosopher, as a musician and a philosopher. He symbolized the form. He said, "Ich bin ein Anbeter der Form." I am an admirer of the form.
Those were the words of Benvenuto Busoni, son of the early 20th century composer Ferruccio Busoni. I'm in the studio with Daniel Revenal, who is a scholar and performer of the works of this composer, and also one of the founding directors of the newly formed Busoni Society. Could you tell us a bit about this society, who was involved, and why it was formed just now?
The Busoni Society was formed in March of 1965 by Rudolf Ganz, Gunnar Johansson, and myself. We are the founding directors of the Busoni Society, and we have made a board of advisors which consists of those older persons who were colleagues or friends of Busoni, and of those young musicians who have discovered Busoni on their own, so to speak. The older members of the board are Benvenuto Busoni, Busoni's son, Pablo Casals, Rudolf Serkin, Arthur Rubinstein, Philip Jarnach, who completed the composition of Busoni's opera Dr. Faust, Otto Luning, who was a composition student of Busoni, Dr. Friedrich Schnapp, the great German Busoni scholar. The young musicians on our board of advisors are Paul Badura-Skoda, Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, John Ogden, and Peter Serkin. Also on our board are the Marquess of Londonderry, who is the trustee of the Busoni Fund in London, an organization similar to ours, and Karin Ulla Petri, the daughter and heir of Egon Petri, who was perhaps Busoni's closest colleague and most intimate friend for a period of over 40 years.
How did you happen to become involved with Busoni?
Well, I was a piano student of Egon Petri. In 1951, I first came to Petri, and I was immediately fascinated by the personality of Busoni as it was portrayed by Petri. I had no knowledge of Busoni's works, and I knew of him from Petri only in the way that he affected Petri. And I felt that Petri, being such a strong personality, was in turn so much influenced throughout his entire life by Busoni that there certainly must be a certain validity to Busoni's personality that was worthy of investigation. This was all before I heard a note of Busoni's works. And it was not until the recording of Arlecchino came out that I ever heard anything from Busoni. It was a charming, light work. It still didn't reveal to me anything worthy of a concentrated effort in the way of research. Then I investigated whatever smaller works of Busoni that I came across and still didn't find any material that would require a great research to shed light upon. In 1959, however, I heard a recording, a tape of the live performance of Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau doing Dr. Faust in London in a concert performance. I was so impressed with the validity of this work that I immediately became interested in Busoni as a composer. Before that, I shared with everyone else a feeling that Busoni was one of the greatest pianists. With the possible exception of Liszt, he was perhaps the greatest pianist, and that he was known as a Bach transcriber, which is certainly out of fashion now. It was done for pragmatic reasons in Busoni's youth, for the same reasons that Liszt transcribed Bach and that Liszt made fantasies of opera themes. Busoni carried on this same tradition. Unfortunately, the name of Busoni carries that stigma and remains hyphenated with Bach. In fact, it might be well to bring up the anecdote here that at one time Mrs. Busoni's wife was introduced as Mrs. Bach Busoni.
I understand that your society is going to be sponsoring an event of major importance in New York in January. Could you tell us something about that?
We are performing the Busoni Piano Concerto in Carnegie Hall on January 26th. It will be the first New York performance of this work. Indeed, it'll be one of the few performances in America. Egon Petri has played it several times in the early 1940s with Hans Kindler, and a few other artists have programmed it. But I dare say that in the last 15 years, it hasn't been performed anywhere in America.
And of course, there is one major obstacle to its performance, which you might tell our audience something about.
Well, there are two obstacles, actually. The first is the tremendous length of the concerto, an hour and 14 minutes, and the fact that it's in five movements, the fifth movement containing a male chorus.
That is the major obstacle I was thinking of. Who are the performers going to be?
Well, the orchestra that the Busoni Society has engaged is the American Symphony Orchestra. The pianist will be Gunnar Johansson, and I will be conducting.
The American Symphony that you mentioned is Leopold Stokowski's orchestra, isn't it, in New York?
Yes, the American Symphony was founded by Maestro Stokowski, and it has always had a great, he's always shown his great enthusiasm for doing new works. For instance, the Ives Symphony, which he recently performed for the first time and recorded. And he was very obliging in allowing the Busoni Society to contract the orchestra for this concert.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the pianist, Gunnar Johansson. He's been associated with this work previously as well, hasn't he?
Yes, Johansson played the Busoni Concerto several times in Europe. The last performance was in 1956 under Hans Schmidt Isserstedt.
And that's the performance which we'll be hearing this evening later on at the end of this program. It might be well to go back a little bit and say a bit more about just who Busoni was as a composer and what his place in musical history is.
Busoni is a transitional figure, can be considered as a kind of link between the 19th and 20th centuries. He appeared at the end of the Romantic era, and in his early years, associated with such characteristically romantic figures as Brahms, Goldmark, Buito, Sibelius, Tchaikovsky, and began at the age of 18 to develop his own critical insights into his time. He was a voluble writer. He wrote many criticisms of music and the musical situation in general for the newspapers in Trieste and in Graz while he was still a teenager, but with great perception and maturity. He wrote under an anagram of Bruno Firosucci.
Do you recall some of his reactions to these early precursors and early contemporaries of his as his own attitudes and his own musical style started to change?
There's a marvelous letter from Busoni to Egon Petri's father, Henri Petri, in which Busoni writes that he was still in his clothes. He had been up all night writing this tormented letter. It seems that Busoni had been invited by Henri Petri on New Year's Eve, to meet and play some of his works for Henri Petri's own teacher, Joachim. When asked to play, Busoni stormed out in a rage. I must say here that in the early period of Busoni's life, he modeled himself a little bit after Bajarov in Fathers and Sons and cultivated this romantic attitude and volatile kind of behavior. He spent the night writing this long letter, decrying Brahms and Joachim and Beethoven as well, these respected figures of the old school who he was moving against. Well, naturally enough, he mentions Richard Strauss as a member of the new movement, but curiously, he also includes Christian Sinding, who must not have lived up to Busoni's expectations of him. Busoni continued throughout his career to associate with artists from every aspect of art, painters, sculptors, poets, as well as musicians. And in his later years, everyone, names which we know very well now, such as Dmitri Tiomkin, Kurt Weill, William Walton, Krennic, Hindemith, came to Busoni as young men to have their works criticized. And artists from other fields, D'Annunzio, Baccioni, Kandinsky, Klee, and Paul Trubetskoy, the sculptor. And he had friendships with Rilke, Shaw, Jakob Wassermann, and even was close to the musicologists, Paul Becker, Hugo Leichtentritt. So you can see that a figure who begins in a friendship with Brahms and ends with Schoenberg and Kurt Weill can, with great justification, be called a transitional figure from a historical point of view.
You mentioned some later even atonal composers that he was associated with in his later years. What sort of influence did he have on composers who came after him? Who studied under him, for instance?
Well, one of my principal reasons for being interested in Busoni is my basic premise that he perhaps had more influence upon his contemporaries and the younger generation of his time than any other single figure. Practically everyone in the music world passed through Busoni's rooms in the Victoria Luise Platz in Berlin at one time or another. Everyone brought works to show him, and there was a regular afternoon or evening gathering at his house where the young composers from all countries came at one time or another. And they're so varied, it's difficult to point out a school of Busoni or a school of his influences, even though in piano playing it's referred to as he comes from the school of Busoni. Well, that's a misnomer in its own right. But such varied personalities as, for instance, Kurt Weill, who gleaned his very essence, in my opinion, from Busoni, from his studies with Busoni, and from Busoni's own style. Then such composers as William Walton brought works to Busoni, Hindemith. And Schoenberg, a very interesting letter from Busoni to Egon Petri, tells that he had an interesting afternoon at home today, that Schoenberg came and brought a new piece of his, which we heard, called Pierre Lumière. Hmm. He said that Schoenberg conducted it, Steuermann played the piano, and Hans Kindler, Wilhelm Mengelberg, and Schnabel were present, and that there was a gathering of intelligent women, and we had tea, Russian cigarettes. He said this was the form that art should take and no other. And then he proceeded for the next four or five pages in the letter to give an analysis of the work, of the style of Schoenberg, and of the historical development of the character of Harlequin as he himself had developed it, in contrast to Schoenberg.
What was his general response to the work?
Very positive. I mean, it represented a new voice, and sometimes, in Busoni's opinion, a little unclear this new voice was, but he had a tremendous respect for it and admiration of it. The same kind of thing can be said about Busoni's attitude towards Stravinsky. Busoni's last venture out, when he was already in his final illness in 1923, was to the first gathering of the Bauhaus in Weimar, which was perhaps one of the most distinguished gatherings in Germany in that entire decade. It was the first performance, the first German performance of Stravinsky's History of a Soldier. Present in the audience, of course, was Stravinsky and Paul Klee, Kandinsky, Walter Gropius, Busoni, Egon Petri, Kurt Weill, and many others. At this performance, Egon Petri played the premiere of the five works for the maintenance of polyphonic playing, which was one of Busoni's last works for piano, which he remarked in a letter to Egon Petri that he had written a little series of piano pieces as the fruits of my convalescence. These works, which Petri gave the first performance of at the Bauhaus at that time. This was the first and only meeting between Stravinsky and Busoni, and although sarcastic comments had been exchanged through emissaries, pupils, who were sent as emissaries from one camp to the other in earlier years in Switzerland, they found a mutual respect, and in fact Busoni was moved to the point of tears by the Stravinsky opera. And in his turn, Stravinsky wrote a touching tribute to Busoni on a program and had it passed hand to hand to Busoni after the performance by Petri of the five polyphonic works.
Well, this certainly counteracts a general impression that perhaps exists that Busoni's association was much more with what had gone before than with what came after him. We've mentioned already his involvement in the other arts. I'm curious as to whether any of his writings survive other than his writings about music and his correspondence.
No. I feel that the eventual publication of a complete edition of Busoni's letters will be of inestimable value from a historical point of view. Busoni wrote letters constantly, and he wrote with great sense of perception and an astute criticism of things going on about him. His letters, of course, to different persons are cast in a different form, but always he wrote with a sense of his own importance and of the importance of his own observations on the events which he was witnessing. The only important collection of letters published so far has been a long out-of-print edition of selection from letters to his wife, which represents roughly one-third of the total number of letters in the collection to his wife. There are remarkable collections, unpublished, which would be of extreme interest not only to musicians, but to anyone interested in this historical period from, let's say, 1885 to 1924. Collections of letters are, in some cases, exchanges of correspondence between Busoni and Mahler, Schoenberg, the tremendous collection of letters to Egon Petri, to Heinrich Schenker, and to many other important persons. There is a reprint of Busoni's New Aesthetic of Music, which was written very early, published for the first time in English. It was quite in advance of its times, prophesying the division of the scale, his construction of the scale, division of the scale was into sixth parts of a tone, prophesying electronic music. Mm-hmm.
Did any of his own late compositions use to any extent at all any of these more radical departures?
No, Busoni considered himself to be a door opener in this way, and I think that he left to others to carry out the ideas which he tried to bring into the world. He did have an instrument constructed in Boston which would produce sixth of tones, and he did make a written attempt to form a new kind of notation for keyboard instruments. In his own writings, in his own compositions, he carried out his own much more personal philosophy of young classicism. Busoni coined this term, which was later misinterpreted as neoclassicism. And by young classicism, Busoni meant a preservation of the sense of form, which was to Busoni the most important aspect in any branch of art, a sense of economy. A summation of my theory about Busoni's preoccupation with form, clarity, and taste in the highest sense of the word can be gained from listening to this excerpt from an interview which I recently recorded with his son Benvenuto in Berlin.
Geschmack, taste, was his first, was one of his first rules. He sometimes he went through the apartment alone in the rooms and said to himself, Geschmack, Geschmack, verlass mich nicht. Don't leave me, taste.
His ideal in this was, of course, Mozart. To achieve musical results in the most economical way possible. In this way, of course, he criticized Richard Strauss, although he was a great admirer of Strauss, but he could be considered rather the opposite of Strauss in the fact that he would eliminate anything he considered dispensable or extraneous and only leave remaining the overall form and the skeleton of the work. Busoni felt that music was an evocative thing and that everything shouldn't be said. He was a master of understatement, and he felt that music, for example, in opera, he felt that the music was a further projection of the words, and that it still was not the last thing, that the music was still only an invocation to the listener's own imagination to continue creating after he had heard the music.
Was he a polisher? Did he spend a considerable amount of time in reworking and refining his compositions after he had completed them?
Well, there is a very strong parallel to Mozart in the fact that Busoni composed in his head, and when he wrote down, it was usually without change. However, once he had completed a piece, he often went back and revised it, mostly with emphasis upon creating a clearer form. I could make the generalization that Busoni's revisions consist exclusively of excisions from the score of what he later considered to be unnecessary segments. In a recent conversation with Professor Jaranach, he also speaks of this mental compositional process of Busoni's.
Worked from 7 o'clock till midday, lunch early. After lunch at 1 o'clock, there were people coming for a short visit, perhaps to then copy. And at 2 o'clock, he went to his study and worked till 4, perhaps for 2 hours. And then he went out with his dog, and he said that this was a time in which he could compose. And at 6 o'clock, he came home, 6 o'clock perhaps, and started to write down what he had composed during his walk, It has a very good memory, marvelous memory. I have seen it that when he went home, his wife had several ladies to tea, you know, and there was a great chattering. And he sat there with his mascara, and he made jokes and spoke with the ladies. It was a writing all the time, you know, the score. And after a while he said, I did not get a father today. Finished. And the score was perfect.
It's like Mozart, huh?
Like Mozart. But he was not very, very happy about that. Neither because he said, I wish I could forget music I have heard in my life. It is not possible for me. He could speak, play 4 hours old operas, you know, Robert le Diable and such things. When he heard something one time, it was enough.
One of the principal reasons for publishing and studying the surviving writings of Busoni is certainly the fact that his involvement in the arts extended far beyond the merely musical sphere, and that he perhaps deserves, as much as any major figure of the early part of this century, the often abused designation of Renaissance man.
Yes, I agree fully with that. In fact, a few weeks ago I read an article which was written by Kurt Weill on the occasion of the first anniversary of Busoni's death, 1925, in which Weill calls him one of the last Renaissance men. Of course, this is an abused title, and with Busoni, the term takes on a particular significance. In my recent conversations with Busoni's son, Benvenuto, in Berlin, he refocused my attention on the fact that early in Busoni's life, he had many paths open to him.
He concentrated himself on music and nothing but music. When he made caricatures in his heydays and when he was younger, this was a joke. This was a hobby. It was no personality, no new man, no new woman that wasn't caricatured by him. We had such a collection, but it's all burnt. He could draw, he could paint when he wanted to, but he hadn't the time. He could translate. He translated Poe, for instance, when he was in the mood. His writings were, for me, too perfect. Not brilliant enough. I like brilliant writing, but not superficial. But he wanted he expressed himself, not too much and not too little. The exact amount of expression. The exact amount of expression, nothing but that, and in his composition the same. So he was a very disciplined man, the most disciplined man, a man of the greatest willpower you ever can imagine. Because he was so gifted as an artist, not as a scientist. His library, for instance, you can in the catalog of his library, can show it. That there was no scientific book there, because there too he had his limitations. He said, I am interested in this and not in this. I won't lose any time with anything that doesn't interest me and build up my personality.
This, of course, doesn't imply that he cut himself off from other avenues of culture. Busoni was perhaps one of the most intellectual musicians, in the highest and truest sense of the word, who has ever lived. His interests extended in every direction, with the single exception of science. He realized that man has limits, and as an individual, he devoted himself to those things which he was interested in. These included painting, oriental art, poetry, literature, almost an obsession with certain aspects of literature, such as Don Quixote, which he had 56 editions of in his fantastic library in Berlin, and his preoccupation with trans-historical figures. This may be more clearly shown by the fact that Busoni's one of the first ideas he had of making an opera was to use the figure of Merlin. And then, of course, his masterwork is Dr. Faust, an idea that pervaded his personality, an association, an identification with Faust, which went on for some 35 years.
And certainly those who are familiar at all with Busoni and with the breadth of his interest can't avoid associating him with the major figure in that opera as perhaps the most distinctively representative work of the man himself.
Yes, I've called it once one of the single most autobiographical artworks. Dr. Faust represents a summing up of Busoni in many ways, not only as a personality. One doesn't have to consider Busoni at all in listening to Faust. The unique aspect, I think, of Faust is that Busoni made his libretto from the original puppet play, and in so far as he was able to, eradicated the influences of Marlowe and Goethe, and certainly stayed away from other operatic treatment of the Faust legend.
Yeah. It's certainly true that the two countries with which Busoni was most intimately associated are those countries in which the tradition of the Renaissance man have perhaps been strongest. Italy during the Renaissance and Germany, particularly during the 18th century at the time of Goethe.
Yes, and it's also well to note that while he was considering Faust, Busoni also had for many years considered doing an opera on the life of Leonardo da Vinci. And he even went to Paris with the express desire to collaborate with D'Annunzio, who had suggested this to him, that he do the libretto. D'Annunzio frightened Busoni a little bit. And
I can't imagine anyone frightening Busoni.
And said that he felt that, D'Annunzio said that he felt that Leonardo was a skeleton with a torch in the place of a head. Busoni had a difficult time pinning D'Annunzio down to anything specific, and the idea fell by the wayside as the image of Faust began to grow for Busoni and his interest became more and more active.
Where does Faust fall in his musical development?
Well, of course, the composition of Faust came very late. The idea of Faust first appears in Busoni's diaries in 1912. While Busoni was living in Zurich during the First World War, he set down the libretto in a week preceding Christmas. He wrote the thing from start to finish and then began seriously composing the opera. I had very interesting conversations recently with Philip Jarnach in Hamburg, who was with Busoni at that time and who was called upon to complete the last few pages of the opera, which were left incomplete at the time of Busoni's death. Busoni wrote the opera backwards, so to speak. He began in the last scene, and then he went back to the middle parts of the opera and did little bits from different sections. He had the overall plan in mind from the very beginning and only waited until such time as he could complete to his own satisfaction. It has been my suspicion, which was corroborated recently by the great Busoni scholar Friedrich Schnapp and by Professor Philip Jarnach, who eventually completed Busoni's Dr. Faust, that Busoni's remnants of Italian superstition kept him from completing the work.
He was Italian, and as an Italian, he was a little superstitious, you know. Perhaps, he thought, if he finishes the opera, then he will die. There is no other explanation possible. He completely refused to discuss the matter with anyone. Quite on the contrary, he went angry, tired to speak with him about Dr. Faustin.
He was working, though, at this time.
He was working, he was trying to work. But I'm sure that the whole opera has been completed before in Zurich, except the scenes in Parma.
There was no material after that,
no
sketches, no nothing.
Not a single note.
And up to that point, was it fully orchestrated or
After the last part. After the last bar, it was completely finished and marvelously written. And not a single sketch, you know, for the last scene. And this is not to be understood.
At the point Busoni leaves Dr. Faust, it is completely, perfectly written. Everything is in place, and the score breaks off abruptly. There are no sketches, there are no signs of effort at carrying on from that point. I think he simply came into a psychological state, and combined with his illness, that made it impossible for him to continue composition.
Did he have the prospect of a performance during his lifetime of this opera?
Yes, he'd been asked in Berlin and already had been asked by the Dresden Opera to perform the work. And there was much pressure upon him. So it was not a case of him feeling that he may finish it only to let it lie fallow for years.
What sources did Jarnach draw on in the conclusion of the work, and how did he set about it?
Jarnach completed Dr. Faust very much against his will, only under the persuasion of Busoni's friends and family. And when he began it, he determined not to use any material of his own, but to extract from other sections of the opera materials which could be combined in such a way as to bring the opera to a logical and satisfying completion. Now, I think that I should say that the fact that Busoni's Dr. Faust was completed by someone else has been overpublicized. It is a matter of only a few pages in the full score. Busoni had the libretto complete. There was every indication of what he wanted to happen, and it was simply the task of a very intelligent musician, such as Jarnach, to recognize Busoni's intentions and carry them out.
So there was no question as to what direction the opera should move in so far as its dramatic conclusion was concerned.
None whatsoever. None whatsoever. And Professor Jarnach and I discussed the fact that the very last bars of the opera are a creation of Jarnach and have always been somewhat unsatisfactory to Jarnach himself. He said that at that time he didn't have the compositional technique to do what he knew Busoni would have done at the point at which the night watchman returns to find the body of Faust, and that he had to rely upon a technical expedience that he knew Busoni would not have utilized.
About how long in duration is that last section that Jarnach completed?
I would say at the most 8 or 9 minutes.
Oh.
So in a 3.5 hour opera, this is relatively insignificant.
Did he call very extensively upon his own earlier works for thematic material?
No, and there are two ways of looking at this. For instance, the theme of the students from Krakow, who bring Faust the magic book and key comes from the second piano sonatina, which he wrote in 1912. It's very difficult to know if Busoni had Faust in mind when he wrote this. It certainly is only explained, the piano sonata is only explained, if one knows Faust. It remains a mystery otherwise. Busoni looked in both directions in his works. Smaller works can be considered as studies for later works, and he often quotes himself in later works. He often quotes earlier works.
A time-honored practice on the part of all major composers,
yes,
certainly.
Not excepting Mozart. However, each major work of Busoni is surrounded by a galaxy, so to speak, of lesser works. And this, I believe, is the reason that the appreciation of Busoni has not been carried out as it should. It's been the misfortune that the only Busoni that has been performed or that has been available on records are the smaller works, which in themselves are relatively insignificant.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, there are certainly economic factors involved in this, and there is the unfortunate tendency, partially the result of the expenses of major production these days, placing emphasis more and more on chamber works and works on a small scale, which can be performed without great expense. One of the things that's happened to opera, of course, in more recent years.
Yes, of course, I agree with that. However, there have been some unlucky choices in those works of Busoni which have been performed and recorded. A case may be considered the international piano competition in Bolzano, Italy, at which for some years the obligatory pieces were taken from Busoni's preludes. Now, these works were the only piano works of Busoni available in print at that time. Every pianist was obliged to learn two of these preludes and found them largely unsatisfactory. I was in Bolzano in this past summer and discussed it with many of the pianists there, and no one had been advised of the fact that these works were written when Busoni was between the ages of 13 and 15, and that when he elected to eliminate the great part of his early output, they were one of the two or three works that he kept in his own catalog listing, because he felt that some of them had a certain value. But if one is to play in one's life one or two works of Busoni, it does more harm than good for the general reputation of Busoni if those two works are from the preludes which he wrote at the age of 14. They are remarkable from that point of view, but when compared with Busoni's total output, they are completely insignificant.
Yes, certainly if Mozart were known principally today by Bastien and Bastien, for instance, it's a pleasant little thing, but would give no indication of the real importance of the composer. Do you think that there's anything that the Busoni Society might be able to do in bringing about the republication of some of these important works that aren't available?
Well, of course, this is a matter largely up to Busoni's publisher, Breikopf & Härtel. We can only encourage it. We can request republication of works that are out of print, and we can request publication of manuscript works. And it's only a question of whether the publishing house considers it a good business proposition from their point of view to acquiesce to our requests. Of course, I feel that this will come about if we create enough interest in Busoni, mm-hmm. and enough requests are made for works of Busoni.
And in this day and age of photo offset printing, it certainly wouldn't be a major undertaking to bring some of these out in photographic duplication.
Breikopf & Härtel has begun doing that. They have issued a small catalog in commemoration of the Busoni Centennial, which contains many works of Busoni in a photo reproduction. However, which is characteristic of the fate of Busoni, many of the most important and significant works have been omitted, whereas some works such as the Opus 16 Etude, which he dedicated to Brahms when he was 17 or 18 years old, have been brought out for the first time since that time.
The piano concerto, which is going to be performed in New York, where does this fall in the history of Busoni's development?
Well, the piano concerto can be considered as a kind of summing up of Busoni's early work. He began in 1902 and finished it in 1904. The first performance was in November 17th, 1904, in Berlin under Karl Muck. The first performance of Busoni's piano concerto was greeted with abuse from the press, as may have been expected. A quotation from one of the reviews states that during five movements, we were submerged in a flood of cacophony, painting the joys of barbarians lusting in war, and the tarantella portrayed the orgies of absinthe drinkers and harlots. Finally, the cantico at the end showed us to our horror that a composer can take seriously the facetious humor of a male voice choral society. It was frightful. The work was written in Busoni's pro-Italian period. All his life, he was drawn by the two influences, German and Italian. Busoni himself was an Italian. Busoni's father was an Italian. And on his father's side, the Busonis, for hundreds of years, had been Italians, originally coming from Corsica. On his mother's side, it was Bavarian and Yugoslavian. However, he left Italy at the age of 17 or 18 and came to Leipzig, where he was immediately influenced in a strong way by the German tradition. Before that, indeed, he had gone as a child to Graz and studied with Remy, which was an anagram of Wilhelm Meyer, W.A. Remy, who was also the teacher of Felix Weingartner. They were both pupils at the same time. The piano concerto represents Busoni's efforts at a full return to the Italian tradition. He manifested this in giving only Italian markings in the score. The title page was written in Italian, and he called himself Ferruccio Busoni from Empoli on the title page. I think he purposely wanted to outdo every other piano concerto and say the last word in gigantic monsters in the way of piano concerti. He drew material for the work from some of his earlier works. He had long considered writing a work based upon Erlenschlager's poem Aladdin, and indeed he was planning this work at the same time the idea of the concerto came to him. The Aladdin plan was abandoned. However, he took verses from Erlenschlager's poem to use as the choral movement. Some of the material of the concerto was taken from an opera that Busoni was beginning at the age of 14. Busoni put everything into this work that he had to say at that moment, with the kind of feeling that he knew that he would never say things in this way again, nor would he say the same kinds of things again. The concerto is gigantic in proportion, in line, in content. It is not startling in any way for innovations or harmony. He uses materials of his forebears, but he does stamp his personality upon this use of the materials. In spite of the concerto's length, it, in the process of composition, was reduced tremendously from Busoni's original sketches.
Without trying to pin it down to a specific school, are there any composers that a rough parallel might be drawn with stylistically?
Well, in the concerto, I will risk saying that it's more of a lighthearted Max Reger style of the Max Reger of the piano concerto, of Reger's piano concerto. I mean, the obvious parallel, of course, is the tremendous length.
Or the Mozart variations, for instance.
Yes, but I think more in the piano concerto. Although Busoni attacks the problem with as great a attitude of seriousness, but the materials he uses are not so serious. He consciously tried to portray Italian life in the Tarantella and used Italian folk songs, sailors' songs, and other material from Naples and Rome. This was a work of a manifestation of all that was Italian in Busoni. These traits came out later on, but they were so intermingled with his adoration of Mozart and Bach that they're scarcely recognizable. However, in this work, one would say, here's an Italian that perhaps had studied seriously German Romantic works, but no one would ever say this is a German composer who had been to Italy.
What other works are going to be performed on this concert in New York?
As the program stands at the moment, the only other work will be the Sarabande and Cortege, which will open the program. It lasts for 20 minutes, then intermission, and then follows the concerto. The Sarabande and Cortege represent an entirely different period of Busoni, the late Busoni. The works were written as studies for his masterwork, Dr. Faust. In the opera, they are much reduced in size, I would say by 50%. I think this will also be the first New York performance of the Sarabande Cortege.
We've had a lot of information about Busoni and his works this evening. Before we hear a part of the concerto itself, maybe you could summarize for us the importance of Busoni and some of the reasons for the formation of the Busoni Society.
It's been my premise that Busoni was one of the most original creative personalities in the early part of the 20th century. His reputation as a composer has been inhibited largely by the fact that he was a pianist of almost legendary stature and a transcriber of the works of Bach, which is totally out of fashion today. An anecdote concerning the pianistic legend is that George Bernard Shaw wrote Busoni a note saying that he should compose under another name, since it was inconceivable that an artist could be so supremely great in two branches of his field. Busoni's prime concern with himself was as a composer, and the entire function of the Busoni Society is to bring Busoni the composer to public recognition. As a composer, he represents within himself a case of almost miraculous development. Busoni's early works, his Opus 3, 4, and 5, show a certain inventiveness, but clearly don't indicate a great genius at work. They certainly don't have the interest of the early works of Mozart or Schubert or even of Beethoven. But then what happens in the course of his development is quite miraculous. At the turn of the century, when he wrote the Lustspiel Overture, 1897, he began an inventiveness in creativity and began to emerge from under the shadows of Brahms, Wagner, and Sibelius, and to assert for the first time his real musical personality and to give a new voice in music, a new sound, which is found in its fullest development, of course, in Dr. Faust. I also feel that Busoni functioned in several ways historically. First, as a kind of link between the 19th and 20th centuries, and secondly, as an instigator of creativity among his contemporaries, and thirdly, as a great provocative influence on the younger musical generation.
Well, this certainly constitutes an impressive argument. What are your personal plans for a continuation of the work that you've been describing?
one of the most significant aspects of my research concerning Busoni has been my project of interviewing, and in many cases recording the interviews, those persons who knew Busoni. Among those whom I've interviewed in the last 5 years have been Egon Petri, his daughter, Karin Ulla Petri, Raffaello Busoni, and Busoni's other son, Benvenuto, Busoni's personal physician, Dr. Hans Meyer, Pablo Casals, Karen Dias, Stefan Volpe, Leo Sirota, of course, my distinguished colleague Rudolf Ganz and Gunnar Johansson, Rosamund Lee, Arthur Rubinstein, Otto Luning, and many others. I found this an extremely efficient way to gather important new material concerning Busoni. In every case, these persons would have been reluctant to write memoirs or reminiscences of Busoni, but were very willing to discuss at length with someone who knew their background in Busoni's, their relationship with Busoni. And in the course of these conversations, many clear and important memories were evoked which would have been lost otherwise. I consider this to be one of the most important aspects of my researches on Busoni, and it's one that I hope to continue as soon as possible. A simple factor of chronology makes it imperative that I continue this activity immediately. Many of the persons who were very close to Busoni have died recently. Some of them, whom I have already interviewed, have died. There remain many important figures to be interviewed, such as Dr. Anzoletti, age 94, who was one of Busoni's closest friends and who heard Busoni play when he was 16 years old.
What is the immediate cause of the Busoni Society having been formed at this particular time?
Well, the most immediate and compelling reason to form the Busoni Society was that 1966 marks the centenary of Busoni's birth. I conceived the idea in 1960 when I was living in Vienna that something should be done for Busoni and that the centenary would provide the suitable opportunity for bringing Busoni's works to a wider public. And in these 5 years, I've concentrated in research on Busoni, collecting materials related to him, studying works, and planning for our activities. The Busoni Society itself came into being in March of 1965. Following its incorporation, we gave a small concert at the University of Wisconsin as a kind of an experiment to see what the reaction would be on the part of audience, students, and other artists. The reaction was very positive towards the works of Busoni. We performed the Indian Fantasy with Gunnar Johansson as soloist and the first American performance of the Lustspiel Overture. We were encouraged to carry on a further experiment, knowing full well that we were anticipating the centenary, but we realized that unless we did something, made a tangible manifestation and began to create interest in Busoni in 1965, that there would be little opportunity for doing anything in 1966. Shortly after the Wisconsin performance, we arranged a small Busoni festival in Indianapolis. This festival was a kind of miniature version of what the Busoni Society hopes to carry out during 1966. It consisted of a piano recital by Gunnar Johansson, a chamber music concert in which were given the two string quartets of Busoni and both of the violin sonatas, and an orchestral concert at which I gave, I assume, the second performance of the Lustspiel Overture, since there'd only been a few weeks between it and the first performance in Wisconsin. And Gunnar Johansson again played the Indian Fantasy. We gave the first performance of the Sarabande and Cortege, and what I think was the first complete performance of the Turandot Suite, a fascinating work in itself. It was written at about the same time as the Piano Concerto for quite a different purpose. It was constructed from incidental music, which Busoni wrote for Max Reinhardt's production in Berlin of Gatzi's Chinese fairy tale Turandot, which incidentally precedes by several years Puccini's efforts in the same direction.
How will the Society continue its work, and what are the general plans you have for the future?
To the present time, the Busoni Society has subsisted upon contributions from individuals and from its own members. Our activities in the future will be largely determined by the interest which we can create and the tangible returns which this interest might produce for the Busoni Society. We are a non-profit corporation, and it's our ultimate goal to become an endowed institution so that we may carry out a program of Busoni concerts regularly and maintain our archive, from which materials in the form of tape recordings, photocopies, Xerox copies, and so forth can be obtained by anyone interested. I have a large personal collection that I've accumulated in the past 5 years, and recently, since the formation of the Busoni Society, many important collections of letters and Busoni materials have been willed to the Busoni Society. I feel that this material should all reside in one place and be made available to the general public. The logical place for this, in my opinion, is at some university library and at an American university. And it's the hope that when this archive is formed, that on an exchange basis, we will be able to obtain microfilms of all Busoni letters and manuscripts which are in other libraries in return for a microfilm of all material contained in our archive, so that for the benefit of the future scholars, there will be in one place at least a copy, if not the original, of every item which refers to Busoni.
Well, this is certainly one of the major obstacles that confronts the student of practically every major composer, both contemporary and in the past, and it would be advantageous to set up such a collection.
It's also another important aspect of our plans for the future, that we would like to institute a regular series of what we will call Busoni concerts, modeled after those concerts which Busoni himself arranged in Berlin from 1902 to 1909, at which he, at his own expense, invited young and then unknown composers to perform or conduct their own works, and at which he performed for the first time works of early composers which either had been forgotten or which had been completely neglected. Among those young composers whom he invited to these concerts in Berlin were Bartok, who incidentally made his only debut as a conductor, conducting his Bear Dance from the suite, and first performances of works by Elgar, Dandy, Carl Nielsen, the first German performance of the Sibelius Second Symphony, and early works from Monteverdi and Vivaldi and other composers that Busoni felt had been neglected. So it is our intention to set up a series of concerts which will carry on with that same ideal in mind, young as yet unknown composers and older compositions which have been neglected. I hope also to bring this traveling Busoni festival, which would consist of concerts representing each genre of Busoni's compositions, lectures, seminar, and an exhibit of Busoni materials, to universities in the United States. I feel that the fullest appreciation for Busoni and of his significance in musical composition is to be obtained at universities in a student environment. Busoni, throughout his life, surrounded himself with the younger generation, and he considered one of his principal functions to be a stimulus to the young people that came to him. Much of his music could be called intellectual. Busoni regarded art as an aristocratic form, which was by definition limited to the few. This is not a popular concept today. Nevertheless, it was the precept upon which Busoni worked and composed. And I think the fullest understanding of this will be had in our universities and music schools.
To conclude this program, we're going to hear a part of the piano concerto, which is going to be performed in New York. Could you tell us just what section we are going to hear in excerpt, which movements?
We'll play the tape beginning with the fourth movement and continuing to the end of the concerto, the fourth and fifth movements. The fourth movement is the Tarantella, which represents Busoni's most intense Italian aspects of the whole concerto. And it leads directly, without pause, into the fifth movement, which is, of course, the movement in which the chorus enters. The performance is by Gunnar Johansson with the North German Radio Orchestra, conducted by Hans Schmidt-Isserstedt.